This is an RNZ podcast.
This is Media Watch. I'm Colin Peacock. The government's been making painful cuts to public spending on public services in plenty of places, and as part of that, it's paused school rebuilds, including even ones that are already underway.
A Rolleston College student wept as she told Education Ministry staff that some classes are being held in corridors.
But how did the slow-burning problem, years in the making, only hit the headlines recently when the current belt-tightening began? But before all that, we look at how the government's put out a new plan to cut more costs and get the country back on track. But is it substance or spin, with the media in mind?
No Mikey, karere tahi I tēnei pō. Welcome to One News this evening. Set targets, take decisions and raise the energy. That's some of the phrasing in the government's newly released action plan outlining its priorities over the next 3 months.
It was TVNZ's Simon Dallow kicking off TVNZ One News last Tuesday with news of the 36-point action plan for the coming quarter, which follows the 49-point plan from the first 100 days of the government. Predictably, perhaps, opposition political parties weren't impressed.
While it includes big-ticket items like establishing a regional infrastructure fund, it also lists more obvious objectives like delivering next month's budget. And the opposition has criticised it, with Labor saying the country shouldn't be run like a company, while the Green Party's calling the plan a 36-point bingo card. Political editor Mikey Sherman reports.
But TVNZ's Mikey Sherman went on to say that it would be effective in political terms because it would be a contrast to the lack of targets and the delivery deficit presided over by the previous government. And she also said it would cement the coalition-government relationships in the public mind. That's especially so for ACT, whose policies were plastered throughout the new plan, according to the political analysts. And TVNZ's Mikey Sherman also said this would be pretty handy for the media as well.
Whether the public agree or disagree with the policies and the work contained in this action plan, at least they know exactly what the government is focusing in on for the next 3 months. It also allows the media to hold the government to account on these specific points.
But also of interest to our media, nowhere in that action plan are the proposals to reform the media. As we've heard recently here on Media Watch, the Media Minister, Melissa Lee, has said that she's working on policy updates and possible changes to outdated media legislation in order to address some of the problems that our news media are currently facing. Last week, the Prime Minister said that those haven't been before Cabinet yet, and it was also reported that New Zealand First has insisted on being in the loop before that happens. So maybe our struggling media companies won't be holding their breath for anything in the next quarter covered by the government's latest action plan. So is that action plan overall then much more than just an exercise in public relations and media management? Well, on his website Politic, Richard Harman added this blunt comment after listing the main points in the plan.
All of the above are contained either within National's election manifesto or the coalition agreements.
And political scientist Grant Duncan said if it was a PR exercise, well, it seemed to have worked. The Prime Minister was talking about it on RNZ's Morning Report and on News Talk ZB with Mike Hosking the next day. And Grant Duncan said we should expect more similar updates in future.
The Luxon government will, presumably, continue to issue quarterly to-do lists with items which they know in advance can be ticked off over the subsequent 3 months. This has the advantage of clarity, but it's self-fulfilling. They can set their own goals, mark their own homework, and then boast about having delivered.
And that was a point that RNZ's deputy political editor Craig McCulloch made like this after the PM had spoken on Morning Report.
The government has set these tasks with the intention of achieving them. At the very least, they're going to claim they've achieved them at the end of this 90-day or so period. No government is going to set itself tasks that it thinks it is going to fail. And I think that explains why some of these tasks, jobs are rather vague and woolly, as they were as well in the 100-day plan.
The Prime Minister did, however, push back at the criticism that he himself was coming over all corporate.
No, I'm running this as a country and it's different from a company, but I am someone who's come to this job over the last 3 years, as you know, from politics, having led large organisations and having turned a lot of things around.
Yet the next day he turned in a bit of corporate speak on News Talk ZB when Mike Hosking asked him if this really was a government of action or just announcements.
It's just recognising that some things are really, you know, discreet and easy, you know, you sort of up and down decision and away you go. Mobile phone ban, right? Get it done, executed, sorted, working great.
Other things like RMA reform, you just keep talking about RMA reform, you have endless meetings and officials and everyone debating, discussing stuff, or you even take those big topics and you chunk them down by decision gates as well through the quarter.
Sticking the word gate onto something in politics usually means it's some sort of scandal, a la Watergate, but a decision gate turns out to be something else again. Hayden Donnell took a look at that in this week's Midweek Media Watch last Wednesday here on RNZ National on Nights with Emile Donovan. If you missed Midweek Media Watch this week, it's on the Media Watch page of the RNZ website, our section of the RNZ app, or you'll find it for free wherever you get your podcasts. Now, also, last Wednesday, this government's new action plan was discussed on TVNZ's Breakfast Show, which headlined the effect on your evening meal.
Your dinner delivery is about to cost more, and so too is the price of that ride into town. Because when the National Government promised no new taxes in the budget, well, that didn't include keeping a pre-planned tax hike scheduled by the last Labor government.
And later that same day, News Hub at 6 headlined Education.
Tēnā tātou kato, good evening. The Associate Education Minister is pledging not to fine parents of truant kids if the family can't afford it.
David Seymour campaigned on spot fines for school absenteeism and is now in charge of the Attendance Action Plan, which features on the government's new to-do list for the next 3 months.
And that was the reason that, about that same time, Checkpoint on RNZ National was asking David Seymour this.
Very quickly, one word, did you ever wag? Yes or no?
No, I love learning.
Fantastic. Thank you for joining us. That is the Associate Education Minister, David Seymour.
And there was much more about our schools and that quarterly action plan, as TVNZ's Mikey Sherman explained.
When it comes to education, the government will advance the rollout of structured literacy for year 1 to 3 students, bring back charter schools, and launch an attendance action plan to get kids back in school, including fines for some parents.
But while the government works on the new plan to get Kiwi kids back into classrooms, it's also running an inquiry into what it says are budget blowouts in school buildings and the way that $30 billion worth of school property is managed. Last week, Education Minister Erica Stanford appointed former Minister of Foreign Affairs Murray McKelly to lead the inquiry and report back on it by July. And in the meantime, many school rebuilds have been paused, among them the biggest one in the country.
A Rolleston College student wept as she told Education Ministry staff that some classes are being held in corridors because the school is bursting at the seams. A community meeting was held in the Canterbury town last night to discuss the Ministry's decision to strip back plans for its second campus, even though construction is already underway. Neva Chittick was there.
Head student Mackenzie Wills broke down as she revealed the impact Rolleston College's rapidly growing role is having on her education.
I have experience sitting in hallways, learning in science classes for classes that are not science. I have experienced so much overcrowdedness.
Well, that was Morning Report last month when the principal of the jam-packed college told News Hub this.
On a national scale, if we were in the Ministry of Education, has talked about Rolleston College senior campus as the number one priority school, if that is the provision for the number one priority school, I worry about other schools.
And a Rolleston school parent, who also happened to be a civil engineer, told the press he was puzzled by reports of blowouts because he thought that they would lock in the contracts for schools years and months in advance. Now that was the same week that the government announced all school construction was under review, and that hit the headlines like this.
A leading principal says a review of planned school works needs to be done quickly. The government's launched an inquiry into planned school property works it says are unrealistic and unaffordable. The Education Ministry has already paused 20 projects, 350 are at risk.
But how big is that problem, and who's to blame for it all? Well, you heard different versions of that in different media, as we'll hear. Now, that suboptimal school building situation surged to the top of the news agenda the day before, when the Prime Minister announced a ministerial inquiry and his Education Minister, Erica Stanford, blamed the previous government.
Labor have left a pattern of systemic and embedded challenges that cannot continue. Time and time again, we see this across multiple portfolios, cost overruns, inability to deliver on projects, and here we go again.
The Prime Minister then also said that the previous government created a situation bordering on a crisis, and it certainly is now for some of the 20 schools whose big bills have been paused, and 300 are the schools in the queue. The principal of Marlborough Girls College told Checkpoint that the multi-million dollar plan to merge her school with Marlborough Boys College in Blenheim was off. But that was also reported on Morning Report way back on February the 9th.
We learned about this when we went to the ministry to say, hey, how is that Marlborough merger going? This is this huge project to merge two colleges intermediate down there. Not well. That one is really, it's not sort of back burner. It's not on any burner. They're just trying to figure out how to make it work because it's at over $170 million. When we asked about that, it transpires actually there's 20 projects that are on hold now.
The day that most schools returned for the year, the minister told Catherine Ryan that trying to sort all this out was like journalism.
I've spent the last 3 months a little bit like an investigative journalist, me and my ministerial advisor, getting to the bottom of what on earth is going on. The journalist and me are going through the same process of how on earth has this happened?
So that was the education minister saying she was working on that list of school building projects to pause. But that didn't go to the top of the national bulletins at that time. Yet the same day, the Otago Daily Times reported that new classrooms at Invercargill's leaky James Hargest College were also now in doubt. And it turns out that back in September last year, RNZ's Phil Pennington was on the case for that too. He reported that, according to Ministry of Education figures released under the Official Information Act, that was one of 111 school building projects worth more than $10 million in the pipeline. More than half of those were between 1 and 5 years late, Phil reported, and a quarter were more than a third over budget. Though by contrast, he said the ministry's figures also showed recently completed projects worth more than $10 million showed that only 2 out of 27 were running over budget, albeit by massive amounts, and many more completed projects were done on time, or nearly. But if you were listening to the Mike Hosking breakfast, you'd have a very different impression of the problem. He accused the former Minister of Education, Jan Tinetti, of budgeting money that the country didn't have.
But you had no money to do it. You were going bankrupt doing it, and an appropriation is just merely Grant going, yeah, carry on. You didn't have any money. He's got less than no money.
You obviously have not sat within budget processes, Mike, to work that process.
I know exactly what a budget process is.
And after that, Mike Hosking deployed his customary tactic, criticising his guest heavily after they're off the air and can't respond.
Hosking. Right, at 7:24, we could spend time, I guess, on the ineptitude of Jan Tinetti, who may well go down as one of our most ineffective education ministers ever. The blowout in school buildings, as the PM suggested, borders on a crisis.
And then Mike Hosking followed up with unflattering feedback from the listeners texting in.
Mike, is Tinetti on the glass Barbie? Mike Tinetti, another Labour financial retard to embarrass them all. Mike.
And there were plenty more hostile and even abusive texts like those within just minutes of the interview going to air.
Christopher Luxon with his broom after the news at News Talk ZB.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Very well. I'm starting to feel sorry for you. There's a bomb going off every day somewhere around your place, isn't
there? Tell me about it.
And prompted like that, the Prime Minister Christopher Luxon went on to say this.
We actually have a similar challenge, if we're honest about it, with respect to hospitals as well, and hard infrastructure that's involved with health and education.
Now, that was an invitation for Mike Hosking to ask, how should we manage schools that are mid-build and maybe even cyclone-struck, where the construction costs were going up by 40%? But Mike Hosking instead asked questions including this.
What is it we're looking for in nursing that's so unique to this country that they can't seem to function here?
Yeah, well, I had the same questions.
And another then texted in who'd noticed that the Prime Minister got a pretty smooth ride on the Mike Hosking breakfast.
The reason is he hasn't done anything apart from open up some envelopes and they've all exploded in his face. Let him get his feet under the table.
Stop opening those envelopes, maybe.
Make a few decisions, get a bit of legislation passed, cross off your 100 days, and then in 3 years' time, after a term, when he comes back and has another crack, if things aren't going well, you watch me give him a hard time. You bet I will.
And that would be a 3-year Hosking honeymoon if you take the host literally there. But seeing as the Prime Minister himself had raised healthcare hold-ups, Mike Hosking could have asked him about the Dunedin hospital rebuild rather than recruitment of nurses in Gore. National had promised to reverse controversial cuts to Dunedin Hospital's huge rebuild in its election campaign, and the Otago Daily Times has been pressing the government for answers ever since. Last week, the paper reported that the new health minister was unwilling to confirm that the promised changes would go ahead, and Dr. Shane Reti's office said there were no updates for the ODT when it asked again this past week. 10 days earlier, the ODT had reported Dr. Shane Reddy has remained silent on the possibility of a private funding arrangement for the new Dunedin Hospital. When the paused school buildings were leading the news, RNZ reported this.
Erica Stanford told Morning Report the review will consider all options the government could use to fund school buildings, including public-private partnerships.
Now, more private-public partnerships for building schools would be a big change and a big opportunity for some in the private sector. And some of Morning Report's listeners were triggered by that, rather than the big sums being spent on the rebuilds in the first place.
This is just a smokescreen by the minister to get more money for tax cuts.
This texter says that we finally got to the nub of it with Stanford. PPPs are what this is all about. Do keep your feedback coming in, texter 2101.
Last week, Education Minister Erica Stanford confirmed to the New Zealand Herald that the government is considering bringing back public-private partnerships for building schools. And someone else with an eye on all this is the online subscriber-based outlet Business Desk, which recently launched The Business of Education, a special series scrutinising the $20 billion-odd of public money going into what it says is the country's 10th biggest industry. Since that series launched, Business Desk's investigations editor Victoria Young has been promoted to overall editor at Business Desk. So how does Business Desk follow the money that comes from the public purse for public services of all kinds? And because education is thought of mostly as a public service, I asked Victoria Young, does that mean it's not often covered in financial terms, even though the sums at stake are huge?
For example, RNZ, John Gerrickson and Phil Pennington, there's heaps of work in this area. For Business Desk, we kind of sit outside the mainstream because we're looking at the money all the time. I mean, we're looking at what impact the money has on outcomes and people, but we're always understanding, looking at the business of, you know, health, waste. And the other thing is, because our core company reporting or listed reporting is so strong, you know, that covers energy, technology, property, those sectors, you know, quite well, because there's a lot of public disclosures. So my remit, you know, in investigations is to look at what's sort of not being covered. And education, you know, these social issues, when we drive into the finances behind them, it's sort of driven by the skill set in my team as well. You know, we've got Cecile Meyer, who's a fantastic social issues reporter, turned into now an award-winning business reporter. So, you know, I thought, oh, this is a natural fit for her. My other investigations reporter, he'd been pitching education stories. And for me personally, my daughter turned 5 this year, so I'm interacting with the school system on a quite a different level. And the other thing as well, of course, is the change in government. Stanford's already said, you know, PPPs, there's going to be a role for the private sector here. There's going to be a role for the companies that we write for and read our articles. So it kind of made sense. I didn't have to sort of think too much about this one.
But, you know, your series makes an interesting point describing education as the country's 10th largest industry. Does it sort of fall between two stools in a way? Like, it's not an industry as big as, you know, farming, or a company as big as Fonterra, or an industry as big as tourism, for example. And yet, because people think of it as a public service, which mostly education is, but not quite as big as health, or things go wrong in health, people die. That's not quite the case in education. Is it sort of between the two somehow?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And I think, you know, one of the things, you know, that's really interesting is there are aspects that should or could be treated quite commercially, like, you know, the school property portfolio is definitely one of those. And for me, it really sort of came to light through a lot of the leaky buildings cases with schools. I mean, that the main case in that settled, but, you know, sitting in court or reading these judgments where you're talking about commercial entities and commercial contracts going wrong, but then, you know, affecting Aotearoa, because literally there's buckets in the hallways. This, you know, this was a problem. It's a social problem, but it's also viewed at from a commercial lens. So I think that's quite interesting and really deserves scrutiny.
Yeah, that's a really startling stat in the series, was the school property portfolio, or the education property portfolio, estimated at $30 billion. As you say there, some of these buildings have big problems. So in one sense, is that the wrong way to look at it? It's actually kind of a liability as well as a kind of billion-dollar sort of asset.
Yeah, absolutely. And also a commercial opportunity for some operators. You know, we had, you know, a data company come and pitch me last year saying, you know, why do schools not use these maintenance tools that we have? And so when you hear anecdotally this whole issue with the problem of principals being bad property managers, you kind of say, well, you know, maybe that is something that's not being properly outsourced, or there's not being a commercial focus on, because you want your principals to worry about education and how that's delivered and less about the roof leaking. There's definitely an opportunity to examine the intersection, and that's something that Business Desk is very interested in.
The school rebuilds became a big issue. So late last month, the government announced it was pausing a lot of them due to what they said were potential or actual budget blowouts in some cases, or 20 big builds, including some already underway. What did your series uncover about, you know, that particular problem?
Yeah, this is a really interesting one because, you know, we started looking at, Cecile Meyer and my team, she started looking at these school rebuilds and design costs, because what she was hearing sort of anecdotally, or, you know, from sources, was that engineers were saying there's just too many design costs. And I mean, we all know construction inflation is, you know, very, very high, and there's issues around that. But, you know, they're saying that in the front end there's an issue. So she put in, you know, quite a few OIAs to have a look at that. And, you know, actually she'd put in this OIA before the Education Minister, Erica Stanford, should have claimed, you know, fancy architects were part of the reason. I mean,
this is the so-called bespoke designs, right? And yet even the Prime Minister saying, how come there's not, you know, simple paint-by-numbers designs that can be rolled out school after school after school on similar sort of sites?
Yeah, like why isn't there prefabrication, or, you know, the Porticom model, or that sort of thing. When we OIA'd for this data overall, you know, what we found is it's not really the case that design is the issue. So we found that it's actually below 10% of capital spending. And then when we talk to the experts, the Infrastructure Commission, obviously the agency that guides infrastructure projects, they say that this is not an issue, because what the ministry actually has been doing is they have been bringing this in-house. Now, what the Infrastructure Commission told us was that education is probably 5 years ahead of other New Zealand government agencies. The ministry, when we spoke to them, you know, they sort of, you know, indicated there are other ways which they can save money, and they are looking at that and continuing to, you know, look at standardised approaches. But it's not that bad, according to the data and according to the Infrastructure Commission. When you hear the story, the individual principal or the individual, you know, parent or child talk about the problem, that's important. Like, I think those voices are very important. What we are doing as well, though, is trying to layer the data on and get that wider perspective so that people can see how frequent the issue really is.
How easy or hard was it to actually get the information on this stuff? For example, there was a story about that sensitive area of how much consultants are being paid, which showed quite a big surge from, I think, over the past 4 years since 2019, 450%. So, you know, more than a fourfold increase on spending on consultants, which is something the current government has said that they want to cut.
We can OIA for these top line figures, and the MOE was way better than Te Whata Ora. Obviously, they were centralising at the time, so there were a lot of data issues there. So the MOE has been very good at getting the raw data to us. We OIA'd for these, and it was really interesting because the ministry were quite coy on what they wanted to say, which was, you know, somewhat ironic given the National Party's rhetoric leading up to the election on how much they wanted to slash consultants and, you know, how much sort of overspending there was. You know, eventually we were able to get some clarity, but not a lot. Like, we know, yeah, we know the numbers, but when we try and dig down to what it's being spent on, that takes a bit more time, I think.
We also had, you know, stories, say one parent who was at the Rolleston School, which is one of the big schools whose big build has been trimmed back, saying, look, I'm a civil engineer. Surely these contracts are done months and weeks in advance. What do we know about, you know, the way that's actually done?
These construction companies, and you just look at Fletcher, these, I won't call them glamour bills, but these sort of key vertical construction projects, these are on razor-tight margins. They're not obviously in control of inflation. So that is a huge factor in how these projects are blowing out. We did an investigation into, we called it the business of blowouts, on this happens, and, you know, is it a, for example, a sort of optimistic minister that announces a certain figure, sort of semi-knowing that they got it is going to blow out, but, you know, just still, you know, the announced price is the announced price. Do we expect, is there a culture of blowouts that we should, you know, be sort of okay with, because we want our principal planners to believe that they can meet a certain cost even if they can't? I mean, that's a whole other sort of infrastructure dynamic that we're just getting into. And actually, Cecile's got another OIA. I think it's hopefully going to peel out some of these layers. So we're not quite there on understanding the picture yet, but we're working on it.
Well, you're now the editor of Business Desk. You know, congratulations on that. Previously, I guess when this series began, you were the investigations editor. But that too is a really important role. I mean, will Business Desk continue putting a lot of effort into investigations and series like this one? Because we're hearing so much across the media that that sort of investigative work is now, you know, getting really difficult to do, especially, you know, in television with the, you know, the cuts we're hearing to news and current affairs programs, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I loved the investigations role. It was so much freedom. And so I'm sort of dragging it along with me, basically. And, you know, I retained my core team of Cecile Meyer, Murray Jones, and our data editor, Andy Fires. But I have a slightly wider focus now. So what we're doing at the moment is basically reassigning many elements of the job. Andy, our data editor, will commission a new series, and Murray Jones will also step up. So, you know, as you were saying, investigative journalism, it is at risk at the moment, and we don't have the production costs of, say, those big TV current affairs shows and so forth. But at the same time, it's expensive for us too. We have to hire the top talent and let them spend basically hours and hours on projects or months on projects, because especially these public sector ones are driven by OIAs. You know, we often have to refine our OIAs. We get better and better, but we do have to do that. That is an expense to us, but what we find at Business Desk is that it generates subscriptions. I mean, our investigations unit generated the most subscriptions, because unique content and exclusives is what people want to pay for, because you're obviously not getting it anywhere else. So,
well, I wonder about that, because I imagine subscribers, you know, would possibly, if you ask them, would say, yes, we want investigative journalism. Is that what they want, or do they just prefer to have like the flow of daily intelligence about business and not necessarily that deep dive stuff?
We can obviously see which articles generate subscriptions, and sometimes it is what we would say a run-of-the-mill currency story or company story, but done well and done by our reporters. So, you know, that's quite important to us. So I guess you are right in saying that we are fortunate that our niche can either pay for it themselves or their boss pays for it, because it's a corporate subscription and they need the information. So that is where business, you know, this is where business journalism has been able to live and sort of thrive. Some of the projects, like the public service project, charities and business of health, we did get NZ On Air funding for. That money allowed us to sort of try doing this and realise that it could be commercially, you know, workable for what we do as a team.
And when politicians, particularly those in government, have been asked about the news media's problems right now, you know, the Prime Minister, for example, said, look, you know, media have got to innovate just like any other industry. They've got to go where the audience is, where the advertisers are, you know, and I guess that means online. But, you know, Business Desk really is an innovation, right? It's a digital age, digitally native product. How do you feel, I guess, as a journalist, you know, working for one of a few digital news startups that really is working out, or seems to be?
I wouldn't really want to weigh in on what the Prime Minister is saying or tell, you know, other mainstream media what to do, because their audiences are different. I mean, it's incredibly sad, the closure and the possibility of job losses for journalism as a whole, right? NZME is, you know, my parent company, we're focused on digital innovation. That's our strategy to ensure that we're sustainable well into the future. You know, being part of Business Desk, we operate in our special place because, you know, we have the split of subscriber revenue and ad revenue. Innovation is scary. I was at MBR when they put up the paywall. And, you know, you're looking at the stats back then and very, very few people were reading the stories at first. It was sort of uncharted times. And, you know, at Business Desk, we have Biddy, our AI bot, and having her on site is uncharted territory and not everyone is comfortable with that. So that's
what,
hard
what does
too.
That do for you?
So Biddy is a bot which basically automatically rewrites NZX press releases. I mean, our reporters, our investigations team, they have a play with writing their OIAs using ChatGPT. We have to do it. We have to look forward. You know, so I hope that, you know, people that are serious about journalism can have a go and try and experiment and do what they can do to stay in the game, I guess.
That was Victoria Young, the editor of Business Desk, who recently replaced Patrick Smilly in that role. He's now the founding editor. Business Desk is currently running a series of stories, as you heard there, called The Business of Education, alongside others under the banner The Business of Government, looking at how public money is spent on our public services and how our public assets are managed. But you will have to be a subscriber to Business Desk to see them. And finally, but just briefly, this weekend, it's 1 month to the day since TVNZ announced that to cut costs, it intended to close its flagship current affairs shows Sunday and Fair Go, as well as its weekday news bulletins Midday and Tonight. And its online youth-focused arm ReNews was also told that its staffing was likely to be cut in half, even though TVNZ had earlier said that its restructuring would prioritise its digital-first strategy. 68 jobs could go under the plan, most of them in news and current affairs. And that announcement came just days after Warner Brothers Discovery announced that it was proposing to close the entire News Hub operation by the end of June. Now, if both these proposals had played out as planned, about 10 to 15% of New Zealand's full-time journalists working for national news outlets could lose their jobs in one go by the middle of the year. But both broadcasters were also at pains to point out that these were just proposals and not fait accompli, and they would consider alternative proposals from the staff. And journalists from both outlets made it plain that they planned to present some. News Hub's Michael Mora, for instance, told the New Zealand Herald this at the time.
As a team, we want to put forward something. We don't know exactly what that will look like, and it would be wrong for me to announce or tell you what we're thinking before I've spoken to my colleagues about that. But we've got to give it a crack, right? It might not make a difference, we don't know, but we have to have a crack and put something forward in the eventuality that we could save part of the newsroom, keep some people employed. That's the aim of the game.
And last month, TVNZ News reported that the Fair Go team was having a go at keeping the 47-year-old show on the screen.
Garth Bray says his team has received plenty of support as they try to find a way to keep going.
But surely this is about more than just money. It's about giving people a fair go, maybe giving us a fair go too.
Well, that was a month ago, so is there still a chance that the management at TVNZ and at Warner Brothers Discovery might just reconsider? Well, TVNZ told MediaWatch this week that TVNZ's news teams have all now provided feedback on the proposals relating to their programs. Some did it in person to TVNZ's executive team, in addition to written submissions, they said. The Fair Go team was one that took up the opportunity, TVNZ confirmed, but TVNZ wouldn't comment on the details of any plans that they'd presented. TVNZ also said that this is an operational matter, so TVNZ's board is not involved in the feedback process, and TVNZ's executive team are still considering this feedback. But not for much longer, perhaps. MediaWatch also understands that TVNZ staff are expecting to hear an answer early next week. Now, TVNZ wouldn't confirm that to MediaWatch either. We indicated when we announced our proposed business changes that the process would conclude in late April, they told us this week, and that is still the case, they insist. And TVNZ added that as the proposals span all business areas, different teams have different timeframes depending on the proposed impact. Meanwhile, over at News Hub, things are even more tight-lipped. It's understood that some staff there are involved in a bid to keep the brand and the service alive, and some journalists in work. But all those contacted by Media Watch lately have said they can't talk about it because consultation with Warner Brothers Discovery is still ongoing. And Media Watch also understands that some staff are subject to non-disclosure agreements to prevent details leaking out, a possible sign that something other than the end of News Hub might be being considered. So watch this space. Well, that's all we have for you on Media Watch this weekend, but we'll be back with more on the media in Midweek Media Watch next Wednesday after 9:30 on Nights with Emile Donovan. And then back again with Media Watch at the same time next weekend here on RNZ National.